Thanks for being with us on The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. 20 years ago, Denzel Washington gave an Oscar-winning performance as a crooked Los Angeles police officer in the movie Training Day. Washington's delivery of the final, brutal, terrifying soliloquy has become the film's most memorable moment.
You think you can do this to me? I'm the police! I run here! You just live here!
I could not get Denzel Washington's chilling performance off my mind on Monday afternoon when I learned that six Los Angeles Police Department employees have filed suit in federal court, alleging that the city's vaccine mandate violates their constitutional rights. Now, about half of LAPD employees are vaccinated, which is considerably lower than the 66% vaccination rate for the general public in Los Angeles. I just want to scream, get the vaccine! So we can get on to some semblance of normal. For my ideological COVID corner, I find the resistance to vaccination by police officers sworn to serve and protect the public to be unconscionable. To my ears, the lawsuit sounds like this.
You think you can do this to me? I'm the police. I run here. You just live here.
Honestly, 1 year ago, I would never have believed that only 53% of Americans would choose vaccination. I would have predicted Black Friday, doorbuster-inspired smackdowns for every available shot. But there is only one thing I am more sure about than the absolute accuracy of my point of view. I'm actually sure that getting our nation past this impasse is going to require all of us to listen more carefully to one another. Why would vulnerable frontline workers like police officers resist a vaccination that could be life-saving for them and those they love? Why would hospital workers who have seen so many suffer and die from COVID-19 refuse to roll up their sleeves? Last week, in a new effort to get more Americans vaccinated, President Joe Biden announced an action plan that includes a vaccine mandate for more than 100 million working Americans.
I'm announcing that the Department of Labor is developing an emergency rule to require all employers with 100 or more employees that together employ over 80 million workers to ensure their workforces are fully vaccinated or show a negative test at least once a week.
And while the Biden administration was prepared for opposition from Republican leaders, it seems like they were a little more surprised to find considerable division among a long-standing ally of the Democratic Party, labor unions. Here's an exchange between CNBC's Scott Wapner and Sarah Nelson, the international president of the Association of Flight Attendants, back on August 12th.
Advocating is one thing, mandating is another. I hear you trying to make a nuance between those two.
Here's what I want to say, though, Scott. The nuances exist because I want to make sure that companies have the things in place that I was talking about. If you are doing all those things, if you are supporting your workers in those ways, then we can support a vaccine mandate. But to just say that we support it without making sure that the companies are taking these other steps is really dishonest and not fair to the workers.
And this is Michael Caine, a New York City teacher who founded New York Teachers for Choice. He's speaking during a rally against New York City's vaccine mandate for teachers and school staff.
We're putting this event on today, along with many rank and file union members who've contacted me, who have come out here, and who have said no to forced vaccine mandates.
Police? Flight attendants? Teachers? Instead of clamoring for vaccine access, many of them are opposing a vaccine mandate. Why? To help us understand, we turn to Stephen Greenhouse, former New York Times labor reporter and author of Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Stephen.
Great to be here.
What is going on?
So unions represent, millions of Americans, and they have mixed views, just as, the overall American population has mixed views. Some unions, the nation's largest nurses union, are 100% behind, the mandate. One of the large teachers unions is enthusiastically backs a mandate. Some teachers protest. Other unions are kind of, well, we're not sure. Yes, we encourage it, but it's really, we're not really into mandates because we don't want you to force things down our members' throats. But they're kind of willing to go along. But they say, we're a union and, you know, we represent our members and we want to discuss, you know, how you're going to implement it. Are you going to fire people? Are you going to suspend people if they don't get vaccinated? And then some unions kind of just chicken out and don't say anything because they worry that if they say they're for a mandate, people will be mad at them. If they say they're against it, people will be mad at them. Then, Melissa, as you just pointed out, it's the law enforcement unions that are most strongly against it, which is surprising because these are the public safety unions. But, you know, here in New York City, where I am, and in many other cities, you see that, you know, members of police unions, you know, less than 50% have been vaccinated. And I think, you know, those are the most conservative unions, the public safety unions, the police unions, the border patrol unions. They supported Trump the most. And I think they've been most affected by this anti-science, don't tread on me, you know, libertarian view of politics.
So this strikes me as a really interesting and troubling intersection. We have had some conversations about police unions on this show before, and we've talked largely about police unions in the context of, I think, what everyone would recognize as direct acts of police violence over and against, for example, unarmed members of the community. But this is a very different kind of violence or threat. The idea that, you know, perhaps you could make a choice not to interact with all kinds of folks. For example, you could choose not to fly and you don't have to interact with flight attendants. But I mean, you don't really get a choice per se to interact with police officers. They make that choice about interacting with you. Don't they have a responsibility to be vaccinated? And shouldn't their unions be moving them in that direction?
I think, as you think, you know, every American, you know, has responsibility to get vaccinated, you know, for the good of public health, you know, for public solidarity, to minimize spread of this horrible disease. And you would think that these public servants, police officers, border patrol agents, firefighters would say, we're here to ensure the safety of the public. And we, more than other unions, more, you know, as much as nurses, more than teachers, we want to get vaccinated. And on the other hand, I think there's kind of this, you know, blue collar, leave me alone streak among many police. Like, we don't want the elite, you know, we don't want the Anthony Fauci's, we don't want the president telling us what we have to do. You know, we're the police, as you quoted Denzel Washington, you know, we run the city. And they're kind of, they bristle against authority, even though they enforce authority. So it's weird that police are so strongly against it. And I think that's because so many police officers are, you know, politically conservative and big fans of Donald Trump. And they, you know, swallow his, you know, vaccines aren't so great, masks aren't so great. And they listen to the Republican governors. And that's left the police department. That's left, you know, many Americans in a bad place, that they're resenting this very, very important tool to improve public health, vaccinations. No.
Having raised teenagers, I'm not completely unfamiliar with the phenomenon of folks who simply to push back against that sense of being controlled will sometimes make choices that are bad for themselves, right? So part of what I'm wondering is, from a leadership perspective, how do you, rather than just impose it, right? And on the one hand, I get it. Like, come on, enough already. Let's do this. But are there other ways, given that we're talking in here about unions, to actually sit down at the table, negotiate? I think it is fair to ask questions if you're a union about, well, what, you know, what happens if someone chooses not to comply? What are some of the steps that you might be able to see employers making relative to unions to move us forward?
Sure. So employers have, some have threatened to fire people if they don't get vaccinated. Some have said, well, we'll suspend you for like 60, you know, we're suspending you for 30 days or 60 days and you better get vaccinated. If not, sorry, we don't want you back here. And you asked, you know, should labor leaders kind of lead the way? I think many labor leaders are trying to lead the way and persuade their rank and file. Vaccines are very important, you know, for your safety, for the public safety, for your coworker safety, and you should do it. And I interviewed Randy Weingarten, the head of the American Federation of Teachers, yesterday, and she's been very outspoken in favor of vaccines. And she says she's getting a lot of pushback from rank and file members who say it's, you know, it's insanely invasive for the government to require that we get vaccinated. But I think, you know, Randy Weingarten sees, for the good of the teachers, for the good of students, for the good of the nation, it would be great if everybody could be vaccinated.
It's worth pointing out that maybe we shouldn't put so much at the feet of labor leaders when we really think about folks who are making it possible for so many not to get vaccinated. It really is Republican governors.
Yes. I mean, we see in Florida, we see in Texas, many union leaders, many parents, many PTAs, many school boards say this is crazy that we have governors who won't let our who won't let us require their kids wear masks. And yes, on one hand, DeSantis of Florida and Abbott of Texas are encouraging people to get vaccinated. But, you know, so many of their supporters are watching Fox News and told that vaccines are a bad thing. So it would be much better, in my view, if those states required vaccines of state employees, of county employees, because there's such an ongoing crisis right now in the South, with the lack of ICU beds right now. Available ICU beds, that it would be great if the governors, work more closely with the unions and school boards and everything to make sure that far more people are vaccinated.
Is there a way to hold accountable those, particularly lawmakers, who are not enforcing masking and vaccine mandates?
To me, not to have people wear masks, not to have people vaccine is just like, it's like you're being in league with the pandemic and, inviting more people to die. So I think mandates are a very helpful tool to minimize the spread of this horrible disease going forward.
Stephen Greenhouse is a former New York Times labor reporter and the author of Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Stephen, thank you for joining us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Many of the nation's largest school districts are requiring teachers to get vaccinated this fall in order to keep their jobs. And teachers' unions in these areas, including Los Angeles and Chicago, have signaled their support for these mandates. But negotiating implementation is complicated. In New York City, an arbiter ruled that the city must give paid work outside the classroom to educators who qualify for religious or medical vaccine exemptions. The teachers' union opposed the city's initial proposal to force unpaid leave on unvaccinated educators with exemptions. All right. Randy Weingarten, let's talk this out, okay? Randy is the president of the American Federation of Teachers. It's good to have you with us, Randy.
Of course. It's really great to hear your voice.
So Randy, AFT has backed vaccine mandates for teachers since early August. Tell me why.
So, first off, let me kind of split vaccines and employer vaccine requirements. We were in the same position as, I think, President Biden, so many others, that we thought that with this vaccine, given, the polarization in this country, that trying to get people to get the shot voluntarily was going to be the most efficacious. It was going to be more effective. It was going to, help spread the word. Peer-to-peer tends to be one of the best ways to create some trust, as well as people talking to their doctors. So, that's in October of 2020, we did a big resolution on vaccines, and, we pushed to have it done voluntarily, but we pushed to have it. And we, as a union, have been historically very pro-vaccine. I am very pro-vaccine. And we wanted everyone who could take it to take it. And frankly, in terms of education and my membership, we were up to, before consideration of vaccine requirements, we were up to about 90% of our membership from, paraprofessionals and bus drivers to, school teachers to intensivist doctors who work for SUNY, we're up to about 90%. The reason we changed was and we changed to, look, we have to work with our employers on any of their vaccine requirements, not oppose them. And and that means having a voice in its implementation and making sure that the exemptions for religious or for medical needs were taken care of. And we changed because of the Delta surge. We have been doing a big back to school campaign all across the country. We gave out $5 million worth of grants involving about 1,800 of our 3,500 locals. And I've been traveling the country. I think I've been in 16 states, 24 cities since August 1. And you saw that that the surge was being, you know, was scary. And so if your North Star is safety, which is what ours has been, and you want to both open schools, keep them open, and keep everyone safe, then the most effective way to do this is vaccines, masks, and ventilation. And so we said we had to do what we could. And that's when we said, let's work with our employers on their vaccine requirements and make sure that teachers have a voice in the implementation. And I'll go one step farther. It's not just UCLA and Chicago. Frankly, if Bill de Blasio had been, as Eric Ward just said in the last couple of days, had been more open to actually working with the unions, I think that they would have had an agreement, not gone to arbitration, like you saw in UCLA and in Chicago. But we as a union, as an employer, AFT as a union, also put in a vaccine policy. We worked it out with our unions, and we also did the kind of options and that the arbitrator ruled in New York City, because you have to make sure you meet fear with facts and that you meet the different needs and make sure that people are protected. That's why you have to have vaccines, but that you have the kind of conditions and thoughtfulness in a policy that is required with, you know, in the middle of a pandemic.
Okay, so here's the challenge for me. And I have typically been a very strong supporter of teachers' unions, in the sense of I've had kids in public schools where there weren't unions and kids in school in places where there are unions, and have found that our educational experience in places where teachers are unionized and protected and have a right to speak on their own employment, it always ends up a better circumstance. That said, I was hot this year, like mad. and I want to put that out there as a parent, because I hear you about 90% of AFT members being vaccinated. But there are 8 million public education employees in the US. Only about, you know, a little over 1 million are AFT members. And I have to say, I have been stunned, just absolutely gobsmacked at the number of educators who want us to return our children to classrooms where they are not vaccinated, when we now know particularly that the Delta variant has this, you know, impact on young people. And when our young people, our little people, don't have the option to be vaccinated, they can't protect themselves. Help me to understand why teachers, who I know love students, I know they want to do the best by them, why in the world is this even a struggle?
You know, this is, first off, vaccines are a way of life. And as you can hear from my voice and from how we've changed policy within the AFT, you know, I believe that everyone who is, you know, in front of a student right now, you know, we have to have those, they have to be vaccinated. And I don't, you can hear, I don't disagree with you. This is what has happened in the United States. There's two bits of disinformation that are terrible. And you see it, frankly, I see it in terms of who it targets. It targets young women. It targets African-American young men. The junk that is on the, on the internet scares people to death. And then you have a bunch of people who, because of the polarization in the country, really have a sense that this is about their freedom. And it has become political as opposed to a public health issue. And so, you know, we think that vaccine requirements are important in terms of creating a safe circumstance for everyone. And so that's part of the reason why all across the country, Melissa, you're seeing our locals work with their employers on these things. But we have to get through it in some ways, sometimes person by person. And the ones that I have a lot of feeling for are people who are immunocompromised or, you know, are scared if they're in like the 9th month of pregnancy. We know the obstetricians and gynecologists have said that, you know, it not only is it safe to take the vaccine, but, you know, you should take the vaccine for a kid who has not yet been born. But that level of disinformation and misinformation combined with this toxic politics that were enabled ideologically by Trump and others has created this maelstrom. You have great teachers people who are otherwise great teachers who just think that we are, you know, that this shot is going to hurt them in some way, form, manner. But we as educators, it's really important that we're doing the work we have to do. That's part of the reason that we're negotiating these kind of plans. And I do believe that if we can get people into school, think about what happened in New York City yesterday. I talked to a bunch of my friends. I was on the road. A bunch of my colleagues. The joy of kids being back in school, the joy of seeing kids, the semblance of normalcy, the rhythm of our lives that school provides. I think that if we can get schools open, keep them open, keep everyone safe, that we'll be able to actually heal the nation far more than we have in the last few years.
One last question for you. Do you think that the public perception of teachers and of teachers unions has been damaged at all during this phase of the pandemic? I feel like early on in the pandemic, there was a recognition when parents had to do the teaching at home or support that teaching at home. It's pretty clear how hard the work is, how valuable it is. But I'm wondering on the back end now, if you think that teachers unions and teachers have been damaged in public perception.
Well, I think that first off, I don't think that there's another profession, maybe with the exception of doctors, that on a voluntary basis had such a high percentage of vaccination. I think if we had seen that all across the country, we wouldn't have the Delta surge right now. So I think what's happened is that teachers always rise to the occasion and do what their kids need. And that's what they've done throughout the pandemic. And, you know, we just have to get through the fears and the polarization and the misinformation that they and others have. So I think there was far worse backlash when you had this incredibly terrible period of time between last November and March and April, when, you know, we were trying to get schools open and you had conservative media suggesting that teachers were lazy when anyone who's ever taught remote, hybrid, or any of this stuff understands exactly what teachers have done. So, you know, they're people too. And let's just say that it's a very small number of people who are concerned about the vaccine. There's even a smaller number of people who have the medical or the religious exemptions. And, you know, I've watched all across the country, us being able to reopen schools, both the trepidation and the joy. And frankly, the places that we're having more problems are the governors like DeSantis and Abbott, who refuse to actually put any safeguards in. So I think, you know, teachers want what kids need, and we'll get through this.
And shout out, let me just say, to both the first grade teacher and my daughter's second grade teacher this year, who have gotten us through the pandemic. They sit in a very special place in my heart. It was hard work, and I so appreciate everything that my school and teachers have done. Randy Weingarten of the AFT, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa. Thank you.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.
Again, personally, I believe that the death penalty, in death penalty cases, there should be no doubt. And put simply, I have doubts about this case. I cannot ignore those doubts, especially when the stakes are life and death. For this reason, my vote is yes, and I recommend commuting the sentence to life with the possibility of parole.
You're listening here to the words of one member of the Oklahoma Parole and Pardons Board. On Monday, the board held a commutation hearing in the case of Julius Jones. Three of the four board members recommended commuting Jones's death sentence into life with the possibility of parole. The recommendation is advanced to the Oklahoma governor, Kevin Stitt, who will make the final decision. Now, Jones was convicted in the 1999 killing of an Edmonton, Oklahoma businessman, but Jones has maintained his innocence throughout more than 20 years of incarceration. The legal effort and social movement to commute Jones's sentence points to inadequate counsel, inconsistent descriptions of the gunman, and a record of bias by the lead prosecutor as being among the deep problems with this conviction. Daniel Forchio is the chief executive officer of Represent Justice, an organization that aims to engage audiences in reimagining the justice system and create demand for change. His organization has been involved in the fight to free Julius Jones, and I asked him to remind us of the key facts of the case.
Julius Jones is an Oklahoman, a black man who was convicted for the murder of Paul Howell, who's an affluent white businessman, in 1999. Julius Jones was then sentenced as part of that conviction to die in the state of Oklahoma. Julius Jones has exhausted all of his appeals. And yet in reviewing the case for Julius, we found ineffective counsel, inconsistent statements made by his co-defendant, and just a complete preponderance of evidence that Julius had not received adequate counsel and had not actually committed the crime. And so that case, which happened now 22 years ago, is now on its final, or has been on its final sort of defense, which is the commutation process through the Pardon and Parole Board.
What happened yesterday in this commutation hearing?
So in the commutation hearing, we heard from the victim's family. We heard from the state's attorney. And we heard from Julius' counsel. Each party was given between 20 to 30 minutes to make their case. The victim's family really talked about just the incredible pain and loss, and my heart breaks for that family and for what they've been through over these past 22 years. That pain is real and is absolutely valid. And then we heard from the state's attorney's office essentially doubling down on their conviction and their practices from 20 years ago, and really just an overall sort of demeaning of Julius' character. At one point, the state's attorney said, well, look at this photo of him while he's currently incarcerated. Look at his tattoos. You can tell he's in a gang. You can tell that he's violent. You can tell that he's a continued threat. And so I found that is the exact same bias that really convicted him in the first place. They didn't actually get into the merits of their case at all. They rather got into what they felt Julius as a person was and had some very demeaning things to say. And then third and finally, we heard from Julius' attorneys, and they talked about evidence that was not presented, which included the inconsistency with the witness description of Julius Jones. Julius had short hair. They mentioned a skull cap with a half inch of hair extending out from under it. That was never interrogated by the Julius attorney at the time, as well as many, many other things that were not interrogated by Julius attorney. What we witnessed is Julius' story finally being able to be told, and to be told completely, thoughtfully, by people who were really dedicated and ethical. And I think that was just incredibly powerful. We also heard from people who've met Julius recently and who speak to just his character and his desire to want to go out in the world and do good, which was equally compelling and important.
We did not hear from Julius himself. Is there a reason for that?
Yeah. So unfortunately, one of the rules in these commutation hearings is that if you are housed in Supermax, you're unable to attend in person. And I have to say to that point, Melissa, there's a lot of rules that have come to light in this process from the time that's allotted for these types of applications to things like not being able to tell your own story and having to have other people tell your story on your behalf or talk about you as a third party. That really need to change. And I think that that's important, deep work that Oklahoma still has left, which is to really make sure, just imagine for a moment, in a state that has already exonerated over 10 people from death row, that people in their commutation applications receive as little as 30 seconds, 45 seconds. And many of the pardon parole board members remarked today that they had never really heard much about Julius until this very day, 30 days from potentially an execution date. So I think that's also incredibly important.
Will Julius be executed in the next 30 days?
No. So thankfully, yesterday's hearing culminated in three of the four pardon and parole board members making a recommendation for life with the possibility of parole. And so that creates an important relief measure for the governor to now accept. The governor has to accept the recommendation that happened yesterday. And so we feel very confident that the governor has confidence in his pardon and parole board and will accept that recommendation, upon which Julius will then, his sentence will be converted to life with parole, which means he'll be eligible for future parole hearings and have an opportunity for potential freedom in the future. And so we're very grateful for that.
For those of us who are following the case, what should we be looking for next? What are the next big steps in this process?
The focus really now is on the governor accepting this recommendation. So I think this vote will become final upon the end of the pardon and parole board session on Wednesday. And at that point, it will go to the governor for acceptance. And I think it's very, very important that the public lets the governor know that they are in favor and in support of this recommendation. If the recommendation is declined or rejected by the governor, then Julius' sentence would be upheld, which would be an incredible tragedy. So yes, I think letting the governor know that, you know, the time is now to accept this recommendation, and Julius has waited far too long for an opportunity of freedom.
Daniel Forchio, Chief Executive Officer of Represent Justice. I know it's not a total win, but I'm sure this is still a little bit easier breathing today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
You can learn more about how to follow Julius Jones's case over at thetakeaway.org.
A house in the middle of our streets. A house in the middle of our streets.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. We are in the midst of a massive real estate boom. Not a bubble, folks. A full-on boom. Mortgage interest rates have plummeted to historic lows. Throughout 2021, the rate on a 30-year fixed mortgage has hovered at or below 3%. And low interest rates make monthly payments more affordable, so buyers can spend more. And spending more is absolutely necessary. Because existing housing is in short supply and new construction is more expensive due to COVID-related supply chain shortages that have raised the cost of lumber and labor. So, high demand, low supply, vanishing interest rates. These are the ingredients for a housing boom. And right now, y'all are feeling the effects.
Hi, this is Meredith. I'm calling from Odessa, Florida, just north of Tampa. We actually bought and sold a home during the pandemic. and it worked out great both times. The home value of our resale is exponential compared to when we bought it nearly 3 years ago, and the value of our new home is actually less than what we're paying.
Hi, my name is Iris. I am calling from Woodcliff Lake in Bergen County, New Jersey. We have not bought or sold a home, but my husband and I were in the market to buy and downsize last winter. It was crazy. Everything was appointment only, obviously, and bids were coming in so fast, there was no time to look at a house twice to check out the details in case renovations were needed. We actually put a bid on a house for way over the asking price. Before it was done, we came to our senses and pulled out. We are very happy to stay put for now.
But for Black Americans and others priced out of this pandemic-fueled housing frenzy, the boom has been more like a bust. Here with me are Ann Price, president of the Insight Center for Community and Economic Development. Ann, welcome.
Great to join you today.
And also Kienga Yamata Taylor, who is professor of African American Studies at Princeton University and author of Race for Profit: How Banks in the Real Estate Industry Undermined Black Homeownership. Professor Taylor, thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I want to start with you, Professor Taylor. Let's talk a little bit about the sort of durable realities of Black homeownership even before the pandemic.
Sure. I think before the pandemic, there were the continuing stories of why Black homeownership remained stuck between 40 and 45%. There had been published articles about continuing patterns of redlining that made it difficult for African Americans to secure home loans. Newsday, a Long Island publication, published a kind of expose in, I believe it was 2018 or 2019, about the racial discriminatory behaviors of realtors in steering Black potential buyers in particular to Black neighborhoods and out of white neighborhoods. And, you know, this was well into the 21st century. And so I think that the patterns of racial discrimination throughout every sector of the housing industry, whether it is in among realtors, whether among bankers, we have now heard the stories from housing assessors, all of this before the pandemic already made it difficult for Black people to break through the glass ceiling into higher ranks of home ownership, which had really stayed between 40 and 45%, even in the more than 50 years after the Fair Housing Act. But now when you layer the issues created by the pandemic onto that, which is higher rates of unemployment for African Americans, when you factor in the ways that the pandemic has disproportionately impacted Black people professionally, economically, it has made it even more difficult with the rising, escalating prices of housing in the major markets across the country for African Americans to take advantage of historically low interest rates and to enter the market. It has become almost impossible. I have a quick anecdote. A friend of mine, a Black woman, attempted to buy a house in the neighborhood that I live in Philadelphia, in Northwest Philadelphia, a home that was already grossly overpriced for its size and its location. And when she submitted a bid, there were 28 other bids for this house, and it ended up selling $108,000 over asking price. And it ultimately went to a young white couple whose parents swooped in and offered cash. When that is the nature of the market, Black women, Black families can't compete in that.
So, Ann, give us the so what. What is the connection here between homeownership and broader issues like racial wealth inequality?
Well, thanks for that question. I mean, I think the big thing is that in this country, we believe that home ownership is kind of the holy grail when it comes to building wealth. But what we don't recognize is that you need wealth underneath to actually own a home. And for Black folks, they just don't build wealth in the same way that whites have been able, white people have been able to build wealth through home ownership, largely because of the neighborhoods in which they live in, because they've been excluded from those markets, and they haven't been able to pass wealth down from generation to generation.
Talk to me about the challenges of buying a home and then actually building value in African-American communities.
You know, we just released a report today called Still Running Up the Down Escalator and How Narratives Shape Our Understanding of Racial Wealth and Equality. And when we think about housing and how narratives around Black criminality have shaped housing inequality for decades, this has really led to a lessening value of homes in Black neighborhoods than in majority white neighborhoods. We have to really recognize that the way in which white people have been able to build wealth in this country through homeownership was done through government policy, done from decades and decades of government policy that allowed low mortgage loan rates and allowed them to move into suburbs. Blacks were excluded from all of those policies. Just in Northern California, where I'm from, 360,000 homes were provided through low interest FHA rates here, mostly to whites. And only 100 Black families got those that advantage, right? So we're talking about large scale exclusion that's had generational impacts. So you need wealth underneath to put a down payment on a home, as professor just mentioned. And we just know that Black people are lacking that wealth because they've been not, you know, been able to pass that down from generation to generation. When we look at wealth for Black families, they have about $24,000 in wealth compared to about $189,000 for white families. And non-housing wealth alone for Black families is about $1,900. So you're really talking about very little money in the first place to put down on the house. But once you get into that home, there are a number of ways in which wealth is stripped away from Black families through the ways that we think about home appraisals and how that's biased. Anything from mortgage insurance rates to tax assessments, which Black people pay typically about $400 more a year than white families, through energy costs. There are just a number of ways that keep Black families from being able to build their wealth through equity and a number of other ways in terms of neighborhoods that white families have an advantage.
So, Anne, we've talked a lot about barriers to becoming a Black homeowner. Are there also barriers to staying a homeowner?
There are definitely barriers to staying a homeowner. Oftentimes, we just think once someone's in a home, they're going to automatically kind of accrue equity in that home and they're going to actually build wealth. But for Black families, that's not necessarily the case. In fact, more than one in three Black families who bought a home after the age of 44 switched to renting. And we know that Black folks take a little bit longer to buy a home because they need to save up for that down payment. And the later that they buy those homes, the likelihood increases that they may actually lose those homes when they become older and end up with actually less wealth. So we have a long road to really think about the ability for Black families to buy homes, especially when we look at millennials. And what's happening with Black millennials is really foretelling for what we might see with Black families in our future. Just really one or two quick things, right? We know that for white millennials, they've been able to really amass more wealth during this pandemic because they have more money invested in stocks and they have been able to buy homes at a higher rate. So two-thirds of white millennials own homes compared to one-third of Black millennials. But what's happening is that Black millennials are not just falling behind white millennials, but also what previous generations amassed in wealth. White millennials are falling behind around 5% of what their previous generations had. But for Black millennials, it's around 52%. So what this is going to mean is that we're seeing about home ownership rates around 22% for Black millennials, very, very low. So if they're unable to really build wealth through home ownership, what's that going to mean for their offspring and being able to pass down the advantage of even being a homeowner to their children?
Right. So in so many ways, what I feel like you've described there is that sort of reversal of the American dream, right? That parents, grandparents presume that their children and their grandchildren will do better than them, right? It's part of why you buy a house, so that you can help to pay for education. You can help to pay for that down payment, right? You can contribute something going forward. Talk to me about one other thing then on this end. Are there places in the country? It's a big country. Housing prices are booming everywhere, but some of the boom started with, you know, median house prices of 100,000, and some of them started where median house prices were 500,000. So are there some places where it is easier for African Americans to break into home ownership?
Well, I think certainly it depends on the market. I live in a very expensive market. It's, you know, homes around here are about $1 million. So homeownership is out of reach for a number of folks. But certainly in areas of the Deep South and in the Midwest, homeownership is more affordable. But we have to really take into account what's also happening with people's incomes, what's happening with, you know, kind of future opportunities, schools, that really say, is it worth it to actually be to buy a home in a place where you don't have many amenities, for example? So yes, you can buy a home more cheaply in some areas, but there might be other costs involved.
Professor Taylor, walk us through, so we just heard from Ann there, the ways that the government policy affects and impacts the ability of white families to build wealth over decades. Walk us through the policies that exist as a possibility, right? Maybe they haven't even been implemented yet, but how might state policy actually begin to correct some of these challenges for African Americans?
Sure. To do that, we have to, you know, have a really sharp assessment of the problem. And, you know, one of the things that I write about in my book, Race for Profit, is that we have to not just look at government policy, which has obviously been a cinching part of the problem beginning in the 1930s, for sure. But it's also, I think, more fundamentally, the way that the government, the federal government, has embraced the production of housing through the private sector as the sole process by which housing is created in this country, that is a big part of the problem. And so when the federal government first created its housing policies as it pertained to home ownership in the 1930s, as our government continues to do, it recruits private people from the private sector, so people from the housing and real estate industries, to call from their so-called best practices to inform how public policy is shaped in the first place. And in real estate, from its very inception, and particularly through the course of the 20th century, best practices have been racism. Best practices have been the exclusion of Black people from white neighborhoods. And so the federal government absorbed those lessons. And we see today that the federal government continues to yoke its policies to the private sector. There is no pretense any longer that the federal government will create housing or will independently manage housing. All of that has been outsourced to the private sector, which continues to this day have racial discrimination and exclusionary practices as part of its best practices as an industry, which is why every year we continue to hear about continued patterns of redlining. We continue to hear about real estate steering, all of the things that we that animated the housing industry in terms of racial exclusion prior to the passage of the Fair Housing Act, continue to be core features of real estate in the United States. And so when we talk about what policies to look at, I think one of them is not necessarily a policy, but it's an inherent understanding that housing will be governed by public private partnerships. And I think that there is a problem with that, not only because of the history of racism in the real estate industry, but the ways in which that partnership undermines the federal government's ability to fully regulate its housing programs. And so to that end, we have the laws on the books that make housing discrimination illegal, that make discrimination in the financing of housing illegal, that make discrimination in renting housing illegal. The bigger question we have to grapple with is why none of those laws are systematically enforced, is why are these patterns allowed to continue? And I think the reason for that is because of the continued relationship in public-private partnerships that makes the federal government vested in the profitable outcome for the private sector, that therein undermines the public, the federal government on federal, local, and state levels, ability to fully regulate, to implement civil rights laws, and to assure a fair and equitable housing market.
Kianga Yamata-Taylor is a professor of African American Studies at Princeton University and author of Race for Profit, How Banks and the Real Estate Industry Undermined Black Homeownership. And Anne Price is the president of the Insight Center for Community Economic Development. Thank you both for joining The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, y'all, that's all we have for you today. And as always, we appreciate you tuning in. Please be sure to come on back tomorrow. And if you're on social media, also be sure to follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway. Our Twitter feed is a pretty exciting place. Just yesterday, the one and only Lizzo added us about a takeaway conversation inspired by her. So come join the conversations happening on Twitter at The Takeaway. You never know who else you'll find there. Thanks so much for hearing us. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Thank you.